like to welcome everyone out this morning, July 26, 2012, session 121, The Lioness of the Lord, the letters of Augusta Cobbs to her husband Brigham Young, 2012 Salt Lake City Sunstone Symposium. Connell O'Donovan is a genealogist with over 30 years' experience and a freelance historian of Mormonism. In 2006, he published the biography of early Black Mormon elder Walker Lewis in the John Wimber Historical Association Journal. Connell will be publishing all of Augusta's letters later this year through the University of Utah Press, and is also currently working on a book about William Smith, the youngest brother of Joseph Smith, and the ecclesiastical crisis he ignited in New England in the mid-1840s, tentatively titled Strange Fire. A Utah native, Connell resided in Santa Cruz, California for nearly 20 years, but recently moved back to Utah. Personally, I'm not sure why he left Brandon Zion, since I live there, but Brian was the inspired one. Brigham had it all wrong when he showed up here. Connell's latest article is a 35-page article in the latest John Whitmer Historical Journal. It's on William Smith's
seventh, approximately 20th wife.
He went through wives as quickly as Hugh Hefner. The title is The Orphan Child, Priscilla Margaret Smith Lowry Williams Staines, 1823 to 1899. It is an amazing article. I can't speak highly enough of this article. Please welcome Connell.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Is that working? Okay. We're still working on our technology.
A couple minutes.
So it's going to be a couple minutes. The projector, there's no way to turn the projector on. So.
Oh, I should have just kept rambling.
You could have rambled. I came to this project. In my larger project, I'm recreating the entire Boston branch of the LDS Church from 1830 to 1860. And that's how I encountered Augusta as a Boston native and a Boston Brahmin. Yay, okay. And when I discovered the vast majority of her letters in the Wisconsin Historical Society archives, I was blown away by their content. And initially, as I started reading them and transcribing them, they were so filled with negativity. I really didn't like her at first. I was just like, wow, you know, she's a whiner, if you know, par excellence. And but as I really started to dig into her life, and I've come to love Augusta. She's uppity and arrogant, but also deeply spiritual and powerful. She stood up to Brigham Young and lived to tell the tale. And for that, I just, you know, my hat is off to her. So there are several collections that house all of her letters, with the Wisconsin Historical Society with having the lion's share. She was born in Beverly, which is just across an inlet from, just north of Salem. In 1802, she was orphaned as a child. Her father died when she was two, and then her mother when she was about 14. And rather than going to live with relatives, she was made a ward of Robert Rantoul, who is still a hero in Beverly. Everyone calls him the Squire. And so the Squire took Augusta into his family. I suspect she was probably treated more as a servant than, you know, a stepchild. She never mentions anywhere in any of her letters or anything having been orphaned. I think it was a really negative experience for her. And a lot of her bravura and her over-the-top, kind of, I guess, arrogance is overcompensating for this really poor childhood she had. That's my thesis. Then in 1822, she married Henry Cobb, who was a Congregationalist, and he was from a Quaker family, a very prominent Quaker family, and then he had originally been a shoemaker in Lynn, Massachusetts, which was the capital of shoemaking in America at that time. And then he moved to Boston and became a merchant and an auctioneer and became really wealthy. And so she had sort of this genteel background. She was a descendant of Revolutionary War heroes, naval heroes and stuff. And she often claimed to have been a descendant or member of the Adams presidential family, and she's not. Her mother's maiden name was Ives, and she claimed to be a member of the Currier Ives family, and she's not. So there's always this projection of her that she's greater than she really was. But with marrying into the Cobb family, she really came into a lot of wealth. Her family had been very wealthy, but then had lost a lot of the money. Well, her mother had been really ill for the last several years of her life, and without a husband to bring in any income, their entire estate went to her medical care. And I have Robert Rantoul, bless his heart, saved every single medical bill that her mother acquired. So you can really be detailed, get detailed, and right towards the end, it's really very sad. Her mother must have been extremely ill. One of the major bills was damage to her bed and linens, and I'm like, oh my goodness, that just sounds really painful. With Henry, she gave birth to 9 children, and then they also took in her stepniece as a foster daughter, Abigail. The children 6 and 7 are kind of in bluish purple because they are also became members of the LDS Church. So after Lucy was born is when she got baptized, and that was by Orson Hyde and Samuel H. Smith in June 1832 in Boston. She was one of the first 5 or 6 people to join the LDS Church in Boston. Brigham Young came to Boston in 1838 on a mission, and she must have met him then. But then he returned in 1843, and that's when they fell in love. They met at Catherine Lewis's house in Lynn, and began a relationship there of some sort. And then in September, at the end of September, Brigham was moving back to Nauvoo, and so she took her 2 youngest children. We'll go back. Number 7, Charlotte, and number 9, George Cobb, she took with her to Nauvoo with Brigham. And as they got to Cincinnati, little George became extremely ill. And at some point during that journey, apparently, she changed his name to Brigham Cobb. She renamed him Brigham instead of George, because she put his corpse in a little tin box and carried it the rest of the way to Nauvoo, and then buried him in Nauvoo, and the Nauvoo neighbor obituary calls him Brigham Cobb, but the family referred to him as George. Once she got back to Nauvoo, she was rebaptized on October 30th, and then she was sealed to Brigham Young on November 2nd, along with Harriet Eliza Cook. But Augusta was married to him first, so she thought she was wife number 2. She didn't know that in the meantime, Brigham had also married Lucy Decker. So she thought she was wife number 2 and that Harriet would be number 3, but then later she found out she was actually wife number 3 and Harriet was number 4. And that really upset her. And that was sort of the beginning of the decline of their relationship. She traveled several times between Boston, and Henry, actually, her husband, came to Nauvoo a couple of times. And then she was endowed in 43. So this is the very first of her many letter, 140 letters to Brigham Young. Is that legible? Can you read that from there? Is there a way to focus this? Or
let me go out and see.
Oh, maybe if the lights could come on too. That's a good one. Excuse me?
Tell us your favorite sentence.
My favorite sentence? Oh, we're going to read the whole thing. I hasten to communicate a few lines to you this morning to say that I cannot come up to the temple this evening with the girls of the other polygamous wives. The Spirit of the Lord forbids, why I know not, but believe I soon shall. One thing I do know, which is I can never be yours in the position you have placed me. For I must have a companion. God knows my heart, and he knows that I can never be happy in that situation of polygamy. But I fully believe he will guide me. Joe.
At least that's something.
This is not a discotheque. In this position, where did I... I can never be happy in that situation, but I fully believe he will guide me in this matter. For to him have I committed my ways. My soul is a weaned child. Never before have I felt so much like clay in the hands of the potter. I thank and adore my Heavenly Father for bringing me to this spot where I can receive everything as from his hands, the bitter as well as the sweet. Oh, may I never grieve his Spirit to depart from me, for surely it is meet indeed to do the will of the Father. I want to see you, but dare not, lest your visit should be productive of no more good than the last. I felt weakened thereby. I felt sensible to use the Savior's words, that virtue had gone out of me as soon as you departed. My sacrifice was laying warm, fresh, and bleeding on the altar. It was a free will offering, but after seeing you, I wanted to snatch it therefrom. But I have overcome the temptation, and in the strength of the Lord, I will overcome that and every other temptation which assails me, for I am resolved to be the Lord's, holy for time and eternity. And if I cannot be sealed to him, the Lord, Jesus Christ, whom my soul loves and longs after, I will take the next step and go to Joseph. And when I get to him, I will open my mouth and order my cause aright. I shall tell him that although the Lord gave me a companion, I have never had one on the earth. And I now demand one at his hands. Think you will he send me away empty? No, verily no. But he will say, Come thou blessed of my Father. I have prepared a place for you. Sit thou on my right hand. And then I'm going to skip down to the bottom. Sooner would I go through another probation than see the hoary heads of my grandparents brought to this. It shall never be said that there is not one of my race capable of governing a kingdom. Soon, far sooner, would I sink into nonentity and let another be raised who would do the work honorably and nobly. P.S. I have now freed my mind in the fear of the Lord, begging that his Spirit would guide my pen and inspire my heart, and leave all in his hands, praying that he will add his blessing to the same. She writes beautifully and really intensely, and I just love her letters. Here's an example of one that I had to try and decipher. They're extremely, many of them, she wrote in pencil. The pieces of paper are really tiny. They're old and folded, and I mean, as you can see, they're very, very difficult. So after being endowed in 45, then she was sealed again to Brigham and received her second anointing on February 2nd, 1846. And then Henry arrived in March of 46, and on that first trip to Nauvoo, he kidnapped Charlotte, the daughter that was the surviving daughter that Augusta had. And here is Augusta's report to Brigham Young about the kidnapping. God has indeed chosen me in the furnace of affliction, for scarcely does one wave pass over me than it is succeeded by another more severe. I am now in the providence of my Heavenly Father, bereaved of my dear child. Her father came into the city last Saturday, stopped at the Nauvoo Mansion, and sent for Charlotte. I wrote him a note and declined sending her, stating that I did not wish him to take her from me, contrary to her wishes, but if he would come where she was at Brother Edwin Woolley's, he could see her. Brother Woolley took the note down and politely invited him to the house. He was not willing to come, however, and said it was very hard that he could not have the privilege of seeing his child. I felt it was rather hard, too, as he was so mild about it. And Brother Woolley took us down in the afternoon to see him. He received me very coldly, but was overjoyed to see Charlotte. She would return with me, however, in spite of his persuasions. The next day he called up to see her, and she told him if she could have one of her playmates go with her, she would go walk with him. I went to Sister Fanny Young's, and Charlotte went after Adeline Young to go with her. He invited them to ride the next morning, and as I stayed at Brother Joseph Young's all night, we got them ready, and he came after them, none of us thinking, but it was all right. He rode immediately to the mansion, went in, wrote a note, saying, "When you receive this, I shall be on my way to Warsaw." He came out, handed the note to Adeline, who brought it to me, and you can judge of my surprise and grief to my only child who was with me, thus cruelly torn from me by the hands of a wicked man. I will not say Father, for he shall never fill that place if I can prevent it. The dear child seemed to have a presentiment that he would take her. And she goes on. And then the P.S. I'm now at Sister Persis Young's, thinking I should be more secure from William Smith. So William was involved in the kidnapping, helping Henry kidnap Charlotte. As I do not know, but they may have laid a plan to kidnap me as well. I feel no rest in my spirit and shall not think until I get away. If I can get among my friends at the East, I shall not fear him, Smith, or Mr. Cobb, but would be sorry to fall in his hands out this way, you know, out on the frontier. And this is Henry Cobb's actual kidnapping letter that he wrote on March 17th. Mrs. Cobb, when you receive this, Charlotte and myself will be on my way to Warsaw. If you wish her to have her clothes, you will pack them immediately and give them to the stage, and I will not depart until they come. When I'm in a place of safety, I will write you more fully. So that he took Charlotte and went back to Boston. I liked it better the other way, but anyway.
Colonel?
Yes?
Does that put a glare on having it there, or do you prefer completely off?
What? It's easier for me to read it if it's completely off. How does everybody else feel?
Off.
So then Augusta left Nauvoo and went back to Boston in 47 to retrieve Charlotte. And in the meantime, Henry Cobb had initiated a divorce suit against Augusta and Brigham for adultery and bigamy. And so Augusta arrived in Boston just in time for the trial, which was held by the Massachusetts State Supreme Court. Originally, I thought, oh, wow, this went all the way to the State Supreme Court. But then I actually found out that all divorce cases in Massachusetts at that time were handled by their Supreme Court. This is the papers that they have a complete divorce case, verbatim testimony, dates of when Henry when Brigham and Augusta had sexual relations in Nauvoo. It's just really, it's a very interesting court case. And then here's the result of that. Besides being the divorce. When the Supreme Court granted the divorce, it was announced in at least 45 papers nationally and the London Times as well. So the fact that Brigham Young had committed adultery and practiced polygamy with Augusta was known broadly at the end of 1847. So here's Thomas Kane, who's in Philadelphia trying to raise funds for the poor Mormons who were, you know, strung out across the prairies and the plains. And he had been doing really well until this divorce suit happened. A divorce has recently been granted in Boston to one Cobb, an inhabitant of that place, from his wife Augusta on the ground of adultery. And your name was directly implicated in the charge. Tom Kane doesn't believe it. He thinks that this is all made up. I should not bring the lie to your notice, for we have always an abundant supply of the staple on hand, but that it happens to be producing a more than ordinary bad effect. We had a meeting for the relief of the suffering people on the Isle of Peninsula a few nights since. Everything was going on swimmingly, and I counted upon raising a large sum for the purpose when this news from Boston came. Since then, it's impossible to keep our heads above water. I cannot get our committee together. I cannot even make decent arrangements for collecting funds. The whole concern will fall to the ground unless the nasty story is corrected. I fear much that there is knavery on the part of all parties concerned. In view of this state of things, it becomes important to me to have the true statement of facts. And I write to you to ask you to send me on such at as early a period as practicable. It is important to stamp the falsehood at once. So their divorce had a profound effect on the state of affairs for the entire Mormon church. Now, as I hinted at earlier, Augusta wanted to be sealed to Jesus Christ as one of his polygamous wives. And so she wrote a formal, what she called the last will and testament, which she had notarized by Willard Richards and Heber C. Kimball, and their signatures, their holographic signatures, appear on this document. And this is her request to be sealed to Jesus Christ as one of his wives. And then in the middle, you'll kind of see, she says, I do this in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by virtue of the holy priesthood vested in me. This is one of two instances in which she writes in 1848 that she was vested with the holy Melchizedek priesthood. Mm-hmm. In the other instance, she writes a letter to her friend back in Boston and gives her what I call a matriarchal blessing. It's a beautiful, long, written-out blessing. It doesn't give a tribal designation, but otherwise, it's a patriarchal blessing for all intents and purposes. And she seals it up by the power of the holy Melchizedek priesthood vested in her. And I think it's really significant that in this document where she states she holds priesthood, Kimball and Richard signed it. Let's see. Failing that, she wants to be sealed to Joseph Smith. And so that is what happens. Here's the sealing record of Brigham Young stands in proxy for Joseph Smith on the 14th of April, 1848 at 7:30 in the evening. And, quote, Brigham Young to give up Augusta Adams to Joseph Smith in the morn of the first resurrection. So her sealing to Brigham Young for eternity is canceled. She remains sealed to him for time, married for time. But her marriage for eternity is moved over to Joseph Smith. And then she migrated to Utah with her daughter Charlotte in Brigham Young's company of 1848. Besides Jesus Christ, here's a growing list of men that she desperately wants to get out of being married to Brigham Young. So she requests St. Paul, Heber C. Kimball, Willard Richards, Daniel H. Wells, Bishop Whitney, John Bernheisel, Father Rhodes, William I. Appleby, Orson Spencer, Ezra Taft Benson, and I like this one. Therefore, as you have counseled me to go ahead and have kindly offered to favor my cause, I would be very much obliged if you would interest Brother Benson in my welfare. He's a good man and a kindred spirit. Therefore, I feel that I could enjoy his society much, and I have no doubt that our union would be blessed with a fine pair of twins. That is my fate. If he will submit to follow my directions, which will be to keep himself entirely for me, as long as wisdom may dictate, and be devoted to me as long as I may desire, whether longer or shorter, we'll leave that to the Spirit of God to direct. Then when we separate, I shall not feel defrauded, and it will be with consent. For I believe in no other principle, and may God keep me hereafter from that man that would abuse my feelings by pursuing any other course. I do not marvel that I have not borne children to you, Brigham. I should have been much astonished if we had been blessed with posterity, for certain it is to my mind that no noble spirit would have been willing to have taken a tabernacle under such ignoble circumstances. I love her. Virtually every Mormon historian who deals with Augusta says that this was a marriage in name only, that they did not have sexual relationships. And it's very clear throughout her letters that they are very sexual together. And this is one instance, you know, where she says, you know, we've tried, but we haven't had kids because, you know, who would want to be born? Your son. Then after Ezra Taft Benson, she writes a riddle. And she sends it. This is the very first meeting of the Utah Territorial Legislature. And it's the day that they're passing the law that legalizes slavery in Utah, and she sends this note to Brigham with this riddle saying, read this before the legislature, and any legislator that can solve the riddle, I'll marry him. It wasn't read. The next, she sends Brigham an ad that he wants to have him put in the Deseret News, and it's just an ad saying that any bishop who would answer the ad, she'll marry him. And here's some choice quotes on how she felt about polygamy, personally, privately. I'd rather have come to somebody that had not some good a wife, such as Bishop Whitney, or peradventure no wife at all, that would suit me best, and I should stand a better chance hereafter. That's 1858, August of 51. I do not make this choice of Dr. Bernheisel from love, but from principle. I have done that once, and words are too feeble to express what it has cost me. No person should love in this order, is my opinion, if they wish to live out half their days. My pride, of which I glory, forbids me, as well as everything within me, to remain with any man longer than he considers me meet for his society. It is now 6 months since you told me I could not have your society, and had you have taken my heart's blood at that time, I could not have been more sensible of the power of death. Since then, I have done my utmost to have my affections crucified, and now I feel willing to have them nailed to the cross of Christ. September 52. In August, August of 52, the church has officially, finally announced that it practices polygamy. This is a month later. The proclamation has now gone forth that we believe it right for a man to have more than one wife. God help them to defend the principle upon righteous principles. But I have been so used up that I do not know as I could open my mouth in its defense. And actually she does. Several times she appears publicly at the tabernacle and makes impassioned pleas in defense of polygamy. But privately, it was eating her alive. That disparity between the public and the private, to me, is just how she could compartmentalize that, I don't know. But it's very intense. And then in 54, could I have had my free and unbiased choice, I should never have placed myself in a situation where there would have been a woman, much less women, stand between me and my husband. You probably recollect that I told you previous to my going into the temple that I had rather take the humblest individual in the church and stand at his side than the highest and have another between us. I am still of the same mind. It is martyrdom to me. Here's just another, very impassioned letter discussing just how much this is. It's crucifying her to have a husband who's not giving back. She really loves Brigham Young and loved him very deeply. But I kind of make a joke in the description that she's kind of like Patsy Cline, beat me, hate me, leave me, I'll always love you. the more he kind of withdrew from her, the more she clung to him. It's just it kind of towards the bottom, she says, if I cannot be your wife, I'm not willing to be your concubine. And then she talks about, actually, she confesses, and let this confession be recorded under it, if you please, that Augusta, the wife of Brigham, stole a bushel of corn from the tithing crib to pay for some meat in the year 1850, and contemplate stealing some more to buy some tea. Having seen that her husband has been sending it around to others, in other words, he's giving tea and stuff to his other wives, but he's not giving any to Augusta, and forgetting her. This was done from pure necessity, and now I bid you farewell, hoping that you will love to take my pills as well as I love to give them. Then we shall be mutually blessed and true yoke fellows in the gospel. And then she signs it disconsolate. And one of my favorite things about her letters is just all the ways that she signs her letters. There's Annie, which was Brigham's pet name for her, the lioness. Augusta, after she got married to Joseph Smith, whenever she was really angry, she would sign it, Smith, and underline it once, twice, or three times if she was really good. Diamond cut diamond, alienness, serenity. You can tell how she was feeling when she wrote the letter by how she signed it. Despondency, disappointment, deliverance. I kind of don't get that one, but sister frailty, a wise woman, your possession in the valley of decision, hope, humorsome, humility, warrior rest. I like that one. The cast down but not forsaken, vicissitude, which means mutability, changeability, contentment, and then a riff on faith, hope, and charity is faithless, hopeless, and heartless. And then a good independence. That, and I question whether there was actual physical abuse from Brigham Young. It could be meditated. It's hard to say. She says whipping and stuff like that, but is it metaphorical? I don't know. I've told you once before, my former husband's, Henry Scourges, was of small cords, but yours has been of scorpions. I like that. I do regret exceedingly that after all the whipping and driving and means that has been used to humble me, I'm still as obdurate as ever and feel just as good as any of the rest of your folks, and sometimes a little better in spite of myself. I do feel so, for you've never heard me backbite any of your family, unless in self-defense, and that's an important qualifier, because she backbites his family a lot, but it's always in self-defense, so she justifies it. Please pick me out a new husband as near one like what Brigham Young used to be as two peas are alike. Only I would have no objections if he would like to not, if he did not like to whip quite so well, as I think I've had enough of that to prove my discipleship. And then regarding her spoiling Charlotte, she says, and now seeing I've got my hands so nicely in for striping, I do not want to give over until I get all I want. I cannot but admire the wisdom that inspires your heart to make your children happy, how you overlook their weaknesses, particularly your sons, and they have lots of weaknesses to overlook, and do all a man could do to keep them in the church. Now, she joined the Utah Council of Health in 1850. Back in Boston, she had received some medical training from Mary Govs Nichols, who was a very early pioneer in female medicine and anatomy. And she may have been a midwife. She kind of hints it several times. I don't know. She was a great opponent of Thomsonian medicine. There was sort of the established medical practice, and then there was this alternative, vaguely homeopathic, herbal medicine, Thomsonian medicine. But, I mean, the majority of Thomsonian medicine was take lobelia, which makes you vomit. And she just felt like, you know, it's probably not a good thing that for every illness that you have, you should just start vomiting. You know, she felt like it should be mild herbs, not strong herbs, common sense, and the priesthood blessing. That was her three-part approach to her way of medicine. And because of her opposition to Thomsonian medicine, the vast majority of the Council of Health were Thomsonian doctors, Phineas Richards, Willard Richards, Patty Bartlett Sessions, etc. And so they butted heads too often, and eventually she was expelled, as this letter talks about. Let's see. To head down towards the bottom, I was cast out of the society called the Board of Health as an evildoer. My sentiments held in derision and myself made an ignoramus, all because I spoke in defense of Dr. Jeter Clinton, who was also not a Thomsonian, and they expelled him as well. Well, may the Lord reward them according to their works. I will have no more, as I wish to do now. Anyway. And then she signs it, "Your holy indignation." That's a she's really upset about being expelled from the society. When she first moved to Salt Lake City, of course, she stayed in a cabin in the fort, which is Pioneer Park. She called this little cabin her nutshell. Then in 1855, she writes that she's living in an apartment, and she kind of implies that it's at the Beehive House. Which was completed in 55, and then the Line House was completed in 56, and at that point she moved over to room 3, which is, there's the basement floor, which was sort of the kitchen and all that stuff, Then there was a middle floor and then a top floor, and she was in the middle floor on the west side of the middle. And her daughter Charlotte was, who at this point in 56, she's now 20 years old, so she gets her own room, and Charlotte is upstairs in room 48, also on the west side, just above her mother. And then Brigham Young doesn't want her in the Lion House anymore and expels her, so he built a house, a small one-room cabin, or a house, it's not a cabin, adobe house, at 51 South State Street. And here's the house right in the center. To the left is the social hall at 49 South State Street. Then there's a little road of fence, and then her one-room house, that was built in 58, and then about 1860, after her son James shows up, he needs a place to live, so he builds the larger addition to the right of that with the porch on it. And then and then further south to the right is an empty lot, and later in the 1880s, the Cobb family builds a large mansion there that's really quite beautiful. That's all now a terrace for a coffee shop. Her son, James Cobb, he attended Amherst and graduated from Dartmouth in 55, and then he came to Utah in 58 to rescue his mother and his sister from Mormonism. And then he converted for about 10 minutes. He initially married, as a non-Mormon, he initially married Mary Van Codd in October 59, and she got pregnant, and then they divorced in March of 61. He was then baptized by Carl G. Mazur in 63. He was endowed and sealed in the endowment house to Camilla Meath in November of 63. The child that she had with Mary Van Codd, we'll get to that in a second. He then served in a mission to the Eastern States in 64. So in his relationship with Brigham Young, he was one of three teachers hired by Brigham to found the Union Academy, which is now the University of Utah, along with Orson Hyde and Carl G. Mazur. Brigham Young is officiated at both of his marriages. His mother, Augusta, is married to Brigham. Then his ex-wife, Mary, marries Brigham in 65. And then his daughter, Luella Van Codd Cobb, married John W. Young. Oh, the webs we weave. Here's a little diagram showing the complexity of all these relationships. And then in 1879, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote this really long article about, it's called A Maze of Marriages, Bewildering Complications in the Life of the Youngs. And in the bottom part, it says, thus Brigham's son, John W., married into, this says Tuella, but it's actually Luella, the daughter of his father's bride, the child of his stepbrother, Cobb, the granddaughter of his stepmother, and his own niece. So James later became a very prominent literary theoretician who corresponded with Oliver Wendell Holmes for years on the question of the authorship of Shakespeare's plays. And then he became an ardent anti-Mormon and assistant editor of the Tribune. He corresponded with scores of early Palmyra and Kirtland residents, trying to get them to tell stories and sign affidavits about the Smith family and Sidney Rigdon and the Spalding theory and all that. And it was his belief that Sidney Rigdon was actually the true founder of Mormonism. Daughter Charlotte married first William S. Godby of the Godbyite movement as his fourth and final wife. They were divorced in 73. She was alleged to have been the primary Godbyite spiritualist medium that helped them found the Church of Zion. And then she married her second cousin, who was also 20 years her junior, John Adams Kirby, in Independence, Missouri. And I believe, at least I'm sure his mother was at RLDS, and he may have been as well, but I don't know that. And Charlotte became actually a very prominent Utah and LDS feminist, but she was much more liberal and progressive than Emmeline B. Wells, and Emmeline had the woman's exponent behind her. And Wells blackballed everything that Charlotte did or said, and Charlotte barely appears in the woman's exponent. even though I would argue to say that Charlotte probably did more for Utah feminism than Emily B. Wells did. And then in 1886, February, Augusta died and she was buried in the Brigham Young Private Cemetery. Here's the layout of the Young Cemetery. The Brigham Young is buried in the upper left-hand corner, which is the southeast corner of the cemetery. And then Mary Ann was next. A spot was reserved for Lucy Decker Young, who hadn't died yet, and then who was wife number two, and then Augusta's wife three was in the next lot. And then after that, it was just sort of a free-for-all of who could get a spot. And then also you'll see at the bottom, Mary Van Cott Cobb, she's there as well. And here's what it originally looked like. So you had to the far right is Brigham Young's grave, and then Mary Ann's stone, then the blank spot that later was occupied by Lucy Decker, and then Augusta's freshly dug grave, and then a wooden marker that says AAC Young on it. In 1889, Charlotte then bought a family plot in the Salt Lake City Cemetery, again, amongst the Young family cemetery up there. So the Cobbs are completely surrounded 360 degrees by Youngs. And then the years later, they erected this big column that says Kirby and Cobb on either side. And then here's Augusta's little tombstone that just now says AAC. Children Charlotte, James, and her grandson, Henry Ives Cobb, the famous Beaux-Arts architect, who was in Salt Lake designing the Boston and Newhouse buildings in 1907. They had Augusta's body exhumed from the private cemetery and moved to the Salt Lake City Cemetery to be with the rest of the family and to remove her from all the tourist traffic at Young Cemetery. Tellingly, all trace of Young was removed from her gravestone and from the family monument. There's absolutely no mention of her having been Brigham Young's wife. When you go there, as I said, she's surrounded by Youngs, and every other wife of Brigham Young that's buried there near her, there's a huge slab and, you know, big letters, wife of Brigham Young. Nothing for Augusta. It's just as if this had never happened. And I think it's because, you know, her daughter Charlotte was sort of a fringe Mormon. James was an anti-Mormon, and her grandson, Henry, was a non-Mormon. So I think they wanted to remove all traces of that from her cemetery. And with that, I would like to end.
Does this work now? Does it work now?
No, yes.
Okay.
So I thought the way we would do it is that I would repeat questions as you ask them, so for the recorder, and Connell can sit there and answer questions, since we're both on mic. Yes?
Was Henry Kennicott, right, her husband, Henry, was he granted, when they got the divorce, was she granted legal custody of Charlotte?
The question is...
Or did they address that issue?
The question is, when the divorce between Henry and Augusta, who was given custody of Charlotte?
That question was not addressed at all in the legal proceedings.
Now, I had to go deal with the lights. Was there a relationship between Charlotte and Brigham Young?
Oh, you would ask me that. there is one rumor that I found recorded that in a trip that Augusta took back to Boston from Utah in 1855, while she was gone, that Brigham Young married Charlotte as well. But there's no record of it. I cannot confirm that rumor. But other than that, no. Brigham pretty much treated her rather well as just a favored daughter. She was quite beautiful, and she thought of herself as a pianist, if you go to the Susie Young Gates papers, which are massive, I found in there this really funny quote where she talks about Charlotte pretending to be a pianist, and that that the cacophony that arose from Charlotte's fingers just would send them all screeching from the room with their ears plugged. But Charlotte thought she was a pianist, and Brigham did too, because he had her entertained at the Lion House. She would come and play the piano for visiting dignitaries on two occasions that I know of. But
I just realized also there is a microphone now. Levine, you have a question. The questions about having a series of husbands?
Requesting.
Or requesting a series of husbands.
I can't explain it. I don't understand. For me, a lot of her letters are really filled with subtle humor, and I'm wondering if this isn't sort of an overarching joke between them, but in a way, but it seems too serious to be a joke in so many of her letters. So I don't understand, unless it was again, maybe it was just a way of her as the knife was entering Brigham's heart, she was kind of twisting it, Well, how about John Bernheisel, or how about Father Rhodes, anybody but you? I don't have an explanation.
Yes. The question is, are there other examples of women requesting to be sealed to Jesus Christ?
I have never heard of anything like this before. I think this is unique in Mormonism. But it actually kind of makes sense within the context of Nauvoo's expanding theology of priesthood and sealings and everything, and the idea that Jesus had been a polygamist with Mary of Bethany and Mary Magdalene, and so why not? I mean, it actually kind of makes sense. And then when you look at Catholicism, every nun is married to Christ, so,
But yes, questions about Augusta's feelings about her priesthood and where the authority began and ended.
Both statements are in 1848. I mean, she's in Utah, but it's still kind of, it's the post-Nauvoo era, and things are still really up in the air, and there is not a lot of settled praxis and doctrine around what is priesthood and was she told this, that she held priesthood, or is this her own idea? I don't know. Is this her own theology? Is this her feminist theology popping up, saying, well, no, I was in doubt, or has she heard this from Joseph or Brigham that she holds priesthood? I can't tell you.
I just would add to that, though. When you presented the patriarchal blessing of sorts, it seemed that she was interpreting that she held a power, that this was not something that was limiting her. She had authority to do things.
It was external, not just internal.
Exactly. Yes.
Given that, as I understand it now, she was sealed to Joseph Smith without ever having had a relationship during his lifetime. Did this happen with a number of women? Was it fairly common for women to be sealed to Joseph Smith who hadn't, without Joseph's approval?
The question is, were other women sealed to Joseph Smith after his death?
Actually, she did have a relationship with Joseph Smith, and she indicates in a couple of her letters that he was interested in being sealed to her while he was still alive. So that does add to it. Then the other part of that is that I think there were kind of two waves of posthumous ceilings to Joseph Smith. There was sort of the wave of the women who had been sort of intimates with Joseph and that circle who did get sealed to him. And then later on, I think in the 1880s or 1890s, there was this huge push of several hundred women who had never known Joseph Smith who got sealed to him in the various temples around the state. I think that's correct, but...
That was not an uncommon thing about these women who Brigham Young or others were pursuing, and Joseph Smith stepping in and saying, hey, you know, you're welcome to marry me also.
Yeah,
Martha Witherton's an excellent example of locking her in the room and trying to get her.
Allegedly.
Yes.
So was William Smith helped the first husband, was he really alienated from the church at that time?
You mean Cobb?
Yeah.
No, when William Smith. When William Smith helped kidnap Charlotte.
Oh, I didn't say I missed that. I'm sorry. Okay, so the question is, was William Smith alienated because of his kidnapping?
No. That wasn't the question. You're asking, what was he alienated from the church at the time that he helped kidnap Charlotte? Yes, he had been excommunicated in October of 45, and this was a year later. He had already attempted to found a different Williamite LDS church in Augusta, Iowa by that point, with himself as president of his LDS church. So yes, he was very alienated from that. But at this point, he'd come back to Nauvoo, and I think that's when... Oh, no. Forget nothing. Forget it. I'm getting confused.
Yes?
What was Augustus standing in the community at this particular time? Was she well-liked, or was she an outcast, you know, with all of her activities going on?
What was Augustus' position in the community here in Salt Lake, Amy?
Yeah.
It was mixed. She appears to have been good friends with Eliza R. Snow. She got along well with a lot of the Woolley family, for example. But she and Patty Bartlett Sessions butted heads over everything. They did not like each other. And I personally don't like Patty Bartlett Sessions that much either, but from what I've read. So, I mean, she had a very strong personality, but she was a very loyal friend. Once she was your friend, you know, she really stayed loyal. But I think, you know, it was about half and half. She was half accepted and half deeply rejected. She was profoundly jealous of all the other Brigham Young's other wives. A lot of her letters deal with that just deep jealousy, and she kind of makes snide and snarky remarks about them constantly. And so with the wives, no, there was some tension. She did get along with Mary Ann Angel Young, the first wife, actually. They were quite close, but the other wives, no.
Yes. The questions, two questions. One is her personality. Would she be classified as having a personality disorder?
Yeah.
And then the second question has to do with her relationship with Patty Sessions and why there was conflict.
Okay. I'm not a psychologist, and I hesitate to diagnose her. I'll tell you personally. I had bipolar disorder until about 10 years ago. Thank goodness for Paxil, that changed my life from night to day. Profoundly suicidal one moment and just ready to conquer the world the next. And that's very present in her letters. She goes through mood swings in her letters. It'll open up with her just hitting the ground running about how much I hate you. The middle of the letter is, I love you and I just want to embrace you and take you under my arms. And then it'll end with, you're the most despicable deadbeat husband I've ever met. You know? I would probably say that she may have been bipolar, you know, manic depressive. Polygamous housewives of Salt Lake City. but, you know, a lot of it, though, really stems from the fact that she felt like she had sacrificed so much. She had sacrificed her husband, most of her children, her good name, the rest of her family, you know, her extended family, had walked across the plains, had suffered so much privation here, the starvation, you know, the locusts, and all, you know, she went through all of that. Brigham Young did not take very good care of her, like he did a lot of his other. He did not support her like he did other wives. So she resorted to stealing from the tithing house to get food. You know, it would drive anybody crazy. You know, that's very. The circumstances of her life are just really amazing. And the second question was
about her relationship.
Oh, Patty Bartlett Sessions. Well, I think it just started out with Thompsonian versus non-Thompsonian medicine. I've read other things where people found Patty Bartlett Sessions to be rather brusque and, you know, not very friendly. So, you know, did that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
Her first meeting with him, she was an adulteress, and you know, I'm kind of troubled by that. And her references to being beat by Brigham Young, would you address that?
The question is her personality of going into an adulterous relationship after meeting Brigham Young, and also the references about her being beaten by Brigham Young. Could I just part of that?
Sure.
We've talked about this. I personally never understood this even attraction to Brigham Young. There's stories of him not being very hygienic, for example. And so I asked Connell, I said, I don't get this cultured woman from Boston having this attraction. So here.
Well, again, I think it goes back to her own sense of unworthiness, having coming out of a childhood poverty and being an orphan child, and so wanting status and power and authority. And Brigham gave her all of that, being his wife, the wife of the president of the LDS Church, you know, the wife of the prophet, gave her so much status. And he was extremely charismatic. You know, I think she really did love him. I think she profoundly, truly felt romantic love for him. And what we all won't do for love, you know, I even be called an adulteress or whatever. You know, so I don't have any more to comment on that. Yeah. And then the other portion is...
You were on, and we've talked about this before, this whole charismatic thing about Brigham Young, because there's the stories of him being in the temple and seeing a really cute young girl getting married and deciding, this guy is really not ready for you. You need to come with me. So, and the young girl going with him.
What was the second part again?
The beatings.
You know, I showed you all the references. I'm going to leave you to interpret whether is that metaphorical? You know, is he browbeating her, or is he getting out a whip and striping her hands with a stick or you know, I don't know. I wish she were more clear. I wish there was some indication, but I'll try to err on the side of compassion for Brigham Young.
Yes.
Was Brigham Young known to
The question is there any other accounts of Brigham beating any of his other wives?
No, I have not heard of any other physical.
Anna Eliza Webb.
I'm sorry, what, Vicki?
Anna Eliza Webb.
Anna Eliza Webb. Vicki suggests maybe Anna Eliza Webb.
Well, what do you know about that? I don't know.
I thought that was in the divorce, that he had beat her.
Okay.
I suggest that possibly in the divorce with Anna Eliza Webb that there might have been some beating.
I hadn't heard that. And then she's always a little suspect, too, because of her sensationalism. And that brings me to another point, is why didn't Brigham Young ever just let Augusta go and marry someone else? To me, it kind of goes back to that old adage of keep your friends close and your enemies closer. She knew a lot. And she could write a lot. She wrote really well and voluminously. And, you know, if she wrote a tell-all book and told the truth, you know, it could be potentially very destructive. And so I think he trod a fine line with her of stay away, but stay a little close enough. You know, I don't want you to go, but I don't want you around me either.
Was she around in September, October 1857?
Yes.
So she was around.
Why?
If she had a tell-all book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did the letters go to the Wisconsin Historical Society?
The question is, why did the letters go to the Wisconsin Historical Society?
That is because James, her son, collected all her letters here in Salt Lake City. And then, as this ardent anti-Mormon, he became friends with a man named Theodore Schrader, who was an anti-Mormon lawyer here in Salt Lake City, who was helping him collect all these affidavits from people in Palmyra and Kirtland and everything. And so James gave the letters to Theodore. Theodore then moved to Wisconsin, and upon his death, he willed his entire collection to the Historical Society. And that's how the majority, the 150 of them, ended up in Wisconsin.
I'd like to thank all of you for attending today. This has been a very enjoyable session. Thank you for all your questions. And thank you, Connor.
Thank you.